matrix, mod matrix theory of the BFSSRIKKT type, and of course, probably the most interesting, which is the ADS-CFT correspondence. In some of these cases, we sort of understand how this comes about, how the additional dimensions can in some sense be deduced from the original theory, original large N theory. And one of the good examples of that is, of course, the C=1 matrix model, where one actually started from the large N theory and, in fact, in a sense, deduced that it's a theory of two-dimensional strings. And there are several interesting suggestions of how ADS comes out of large N theories, but I think it's probably fair to say that we do not have any kind of solid understanding of this way of thinking. All these models which I've talked about involve large N matrices, and it has been known from the work of Itouft, one of the earliest examples of large N expansion, is that large N theories of large N matrices give rise to string theories, basically because the Feynman diagrams can be thought of as tilings of two-dimensional surfaces. That was the original idea. And in lucky circumstances, typically like the strong coupling limit of some large N theory, this kind of string theory can be truncated to low energy supergravity. And that is, in fact, the regime where this thing can, in practical terms, is very useful and has been very insightful on both sides of the duality. There are, however, another class of models which are known to display ADS-CFT kind of duality, and these are vector models. These are models where the large N degrees of freedom are not matrices but vectors. And vector models do not give rise to string theories. They give rise to things called branched polymers or, you know, other things. You know, they're certainly not strings. Nevertheless, it was, in fact, probably one of the earliest conjectures by Klebanov and Polyakov that one class of such models, which are very useful in statistical mechanics, is the ON vector models, are actually dual to some theory in ADS space. What I mean by ADS, the dual model, these are the critical points of the ON vector model, are dual to some theories in ADS space, which is not conventional Einstein gravity plus some other fields, but a theory of an infinite number of higher spin gauge fields, which are called the Vasiliev theories. The higher spin currents, so this theory has, in this particular case, this theory has a one scalar in the bulk, and then there is a spin 2 graviton, then there is a spin 4 something, and there is a spin 6 something. All of them are massless. So you might think this is madness because it's an intrinsically non-local theory. But there have been recently some hints that this may not be really madness. They are actually embeddable in string theory. And of course, by definition, which is anything is embeddable in string theory is not madness. So I think we are happy about it. So for each of these higher spin gauge invariances, there are, of course, currents which are conserved. And those the higher spin fields themselves are, in fact, dual to the higher spin currents which you can construct in the ON vector model itself. So that's how the duality actually works. The Lagrangian, just to give an illustration of what's really going on in these models, so this is the standard Lagrangian for the ON linear sigma model. This has a flow diagram in the coupling, in the dimensionless coupling lambda naught of the phi-4 coupling, where there's a UV fixed point, which is a free field theory, and an infrared fixed point, which is the Wilson-Fisher theory. And the conjecture is that this UV theory is what it would correspond to an alternative quantization of a scalar field in ADS. As we will see, it turns out that this thing is dual to a theory which has a scalar field in the bulk whose mass square is negative but lies in this Klebanov-Witten window where you can have two distinct quantizations. And the infrared theory is the Wilson-Fisher fixed point is dual to the standard quantization of the theory. There has been a fair amount of evidence for this conjecture, rather detailed evidence in terms of computations of three and higher point functions, which have been shown in some very impressive work by Giombi and Yin, that they match very well on both the sides. And there have been an interesting development of related dualities which relate to two-dimensional conformal field theories with the theories on ADS3. For example, there is a dual of the two-dimensional Ising model or the two-dimensional tricritical Ising model. I mean, there have been identified duals for the conformal series in two dimensions. And as I said, recently it has also been realized these dualities could in fact be special cases of dualities in string theory, which I'm not going to talk about. Quite some time ago, around the time of when Klebanov and Polyakov proposed this duality with Antal Zhivicki, we thought that we have a way of a direct way of constructing the bulk higher spin fields directly from the large N theory. And I'll now just review that and see what happens if we follow our nose to the same thing for another theory which is claimed to be dual to a de Sitter space and not an anti-de Sitter space. Okay. The way it goes is as follows. So what we are interested in is the singlet sector of these theories, of theories typical like the O-N vector models. Looking at the singlet sector is pretty much like looking at a quantum mechanics problem where we want the S-wave Hamiltonian of a theory. So for example, if I have a Hamiltonian which has a spherically symmetric potential, say for example in D dimensions, we know how to do this. We change variables to the polar coordinates. That's quite easy. There is a well-known Jacobian which comes from the change of variables. And when you write the Hamiltonian acting on the suitably rescaled wave function, it sort of looks like this. There's an effective potential which includes the original spherical symmetric potential and something which we usually call the centrifugal term. The centrifugal term, of course, vanishes for d equal to 3, I mean, since we are doing the S wave, but for general dimensions, it actually doesn't vanish. And this is the general form of the theory. I have done this for a Hamiltonian, which implicitly has in the background the Lorentzian spacetime. But you could think of this Hamiltonian as the log of the transfer matrix if you are doing a Euclidean theory as well. Okay. The idea is to do the same thing for the quantum field theory. And this is where the vector nature of the degrees of freedom become important. Because if these fields are vectors, this is all the invariants which you can form are basically made out of these bilocal objects. Now, that is not true. This thing was a matrix. It could have an infinite number of such invariants, which is not the case here. So the idea is, therefore, to write down the theory in terms of this bilocal field, which we are going to call the collective fields. Now, there is a technology to do that. And the technology was invented long time ago by Sakita and Zhivicki. And I'll just write down the answer of what you get when you write down the singlet sector Hamiltonian starting with the original vector model. The answer sort of looks like this. Looks pretty complicated, but actually it's not. So let me explain the notation here. Sigma is this field, this. It's a bilocal field, and therefore it is considered as a matrix with x and y as the indices of the matrix, and the trace refers to actually integral over x and y. Pi of sigma is the canonically conjugate momentum to sigma. And the rest of the terms are actually quite easy. You just rewrite the original model in terms of sigma. This is the non-trivial part. This is the part which comes from the change of variables and the Jacobian which accompanies it. The conjecture is that this bilocal field is in fact a collection of an infinite number of fields, one for each even spin, except those fields are living in one more dimension. And let me see how that comes about. At conformal points, this higher dimensional bulk in which these fields live is naturally an ADS space, just because it must have the right symmetries of the original conformal field theory. To see how it can possibly come about, let's just make a slight change of variables from, I have a bilocal field with two points x and y. So I make to the center of mass and the relative coordinates, and let me work in two space dimensions. So each of them is a two-dimensional vector. This is center of mass and the relative vector, and write the relative vector in terms of its magnitude and an angle. So then this bilocal object can be Fourier transformed in the theta direction in this, what happened? Important action needed. Is there some action needed? No? Okay, done. And the Fourier coefficients of this expansion are objects which are functions of two space directions which come from U and an additional space-like coordinate R, which is positive, that's by definition. Time is always hanging around there because we're just doing the Hamiltonian formalism. Because of the original symmetry of the field under interchange of X and Y, it's clear that only even integers are going to come in the Fourier expansion, because interchanging X and Y is like changing the sign of the vector V. And therefore, what we have here are a set of, for each M, an integer, exactly two fields. And these are to be identified as the same number as the two helicity modes for an each even spin in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Because in 3 plus 1 dimensions, regardless of the spin of the field, you always have, if it is a massless field, it's only have two helicity modes. It turns out the same counting works for higher dimensions, but I'm not going to go into that. So from this point of view, got a set of fields in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and it might be very natural to consider this object R, in fact, to be like the Poincaré coordinate. After all, scaling X and Y also scales R, so that is like a scale. But that does not turn out to be entirely correct. What turns out to be correct is something related, not too far, but it also reminds you of the way the extra dimension appears in the C equal to 1 matrix model. What turns out to be correct is that one needs to make a non-local transformation of the field, which I've written out here. I don't expect you to go through it. But the fact to emphasize is that there is a non-local transformation known which maps the fields written the way I have written into standard fields in ADS4 space. And this is the work of DiMelo, Koch, Givikijin, and Rodriguez last year. So now there is a complete map between the vector model fields and a direct construction of the fields, the higher spin fields, although because we are only dealing with the physical fields, it's always done in a physical gauge where, you know, all the gauge degrees of freedoms have been eliminated. Recently, Aninos, Hartmann, and Strominger conjectures, if you replace the ON vector model by an SPN vector model, just change that global symmetry group, what you get is a Vasiliev theory. By Vasiliev theory, I mean this strange theory with infinite number of higher spin fields, not in an ADS space, but in a De Sitter space. Now, this is an intriguing proposal, like any real proposal about DSCFT, because we are sort of used to of an emergence of a spatial dimension from large n degrees of freedom, but it's a bit weird how time can actually emerge as an emergent direction. Because if it is ds CFT, then the claim is that there is an Euclidean CFT which is dual to real de Sitter space. So it's that extra dimension is the time of de Sitter space. Why does it happen? So that was quite intriguing for us. So what we decided, we said we just follow our nose and see what happens if we apply this technology to the SPN model. What we will find is a description of the singlet fields of this model, which is strange in many, many respects, but self-consistent in the way it is. And what we will find is that there is a natural interpretation of this model where this extra coordinate has to be interpreted as a time-like coordinate rather as a space-like coordinate. And I'll explain why. So let me define what the model is. What the model, this model is a model of ghosts, what we usually call Fadeev Popov ghosts in quantum field theory. Namely, this is a model of scalar fields with the conventional Klein-Gordon-like action, but the field is fermionic. These are Grassmann variables. So this is one way of writing down the action of this model. There are a pair of there are n pairs of Grassmann variables phi 1 and phi 2 with an index I which runs from 1 to n. There's an action which I have taken to be real and the Hamiltonian which is Hermitian. The phi fields are Hermitian, the p fields are anti-Hermitian. It's all tied with the Grassmann nature, which is why there are these additional I's which hang around. The non-trivial anti-commutation relationships are also a bit strange because these anti-commutation relationships, for example, can be deduced by requiring this action to by a path integral to give rise to this Hamiltonian. And you notice that it has a minus I for the anti-commutator between the Grassmann position and the Grassmann momentum. But this stuff is actually quite well known. It was worked out by Hinault and Teitelbaum many, many years ago and by some other people. And we closely follow their work in what we do now. So just like the O(n) vector model, because of the large n degrees, the large n index is a single index, then all the SP2n invariants can be written in terms of a bilocal object, which I call rho of x and y. This is a Grassmann even object, but I would like to emphasize it's a Grassmann even object, but it's not like a scalar thing, because this is, as we will see, I mean, some sufficient power of rho is going to vanish. So this will actually play an important role in what we're going to do. I should make a parenthetical remark that the same action actually has a UN symmetry. The UN symmetry becomes manifest if you write it in terms of these complex conjugate pair of fields, but everything which is a UN invariant is not an SP2N invariant. We are going to only work in the sector where the states are invariant under the SP2N symmetry. So that's the difference. The conjecture of, no, why is it that you would think that there is such a duality to de Sitter space rather than anti-de Sitter space? And it comes from this equation. What this equation does is to relate the correlation functions of these objects. I'm sort of rewording, you can instead, as you might have imagined, you can sort of expand this bilocal field around a common point and write it in terms of, you know, local objects which have arbitrary derivatives in terms of it. Those are, in fact, the currents, the higher spin currents. In any case, the correlation functions of this in the SPN theory are related to the correlation functions of the ON theory by a simple minus sign, regardless of how many factors of rho are in there. This is a result which can be easily shown to leading order in the large N expansion. And in the leading order, each side is proportional to N. So sometimes one says what this means is replacing N by minus N. Okay. What does this mean? When you go to the gravity dual, the way n appears is, of course, in the square of the ADS radius. So if there was a ADS duality, the R ADS square would be proportional to n. This is in L Planck units. And it is well known that if I change n to minus n, so n to minus n is like changing R ADS to I times R. And it's well known if I take R to IR and a coordinate Z to I tau, the Euclidean ADS metric becomes the DS metric. Okay. So that was the motivation to propose that there is such a duality. This thing becomes troublesome if you try to do unusual string theory or supergravity theory, because fluxes tend to become imaginary. But in the Vasiliev theory, this has been shown to be a perfectly nice analytic continuation, which takes you from the Vasiliev theory in ADS space to Vasiliev theory in the DS space. So this thing somehow makes sense. It's a little more maybe complex than that, because some of these recent works do claim that this is actually a corner of string theory, but with a slightly different understanding. So in the following, what we will try to argue is why this kind of interpretation, this kind of analytic continuation, is in a sense quite natural and almost forced to you just by following your nose and looking what the theory looks like. Okay, so let me discuss the quantization of the free theory. The free theory is a UV fixed point of whatever you started out with. So free theory, of course, is a collection of harmonic oscillators. So here what I have done is expanded the field operator in terms of the standard annihilation and creation operators. And what you would notice is that there is a crucial minus sign in one of the anti-commutators. This minus sign is responsible for the presence of ghosts in the theory. This is, of course, a theory of ghosts. And if you write it in terms of not these, but some complex combinations of those, it becomes quite apparent what are the states which are the ghost-like states of negative norm. The Hamiltonian also has this kind of structure. But nevertheless, the way I have defined things here, the alphas are still the annihilation operators, and alpha daggers are still the creation operators. Now, because this is a theory of Grassmann's, theory of fermions, it has a lowest energy state, and it also has a highest energy state, because sufficient powers of alpha is going to kill. It's going to become zero. So the lowest energy state I'll call denote by zero, called the vacuum. This is defined by whatever state is killed by alpha. The highest energy state is whatever state is killed by alpha dagger. And in fact, the energy spectrum of the theory looks like this. As you can see, for n equal to zero, the ground state energy is minus k times n instead of plus. That's the fermionic nature of the theory. And you work up your way all the up to plus n times k. So that is the spectrum. For what we will do, it will be important to look at what the wave functions of these states are. So I have written as the wave functions in terms of these, in a representation where what I'll call the analog of the coordinate representations, where you have the phis and the momenta as del del phis. Of course, most of these, a large number of these states are not singlets. The singlet states can only be formed if I have two of these alpha daggers which are acting on the vacuum so that the index can be contracted. So, however, therefore, we need to look at the singlet states of the theory and not all the states of the theory. A useful way to do that again is to look at the collective variables. So what are the collective variables here? Just to refresh of what these things would be, let's go back to the O-N oscillator. See, the O-N oscillator, so there are N coordinates xi, and you could take the collective variable as this xi square, which is the radius square, I mean, in usual polar coordinates. And here is the Jacobian for the change of variables from the x to the sigmas, which leads to what I call the collective Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has a pair of terms. This is the usual oscillator term. This was k square x square, which I've just written as k square times sigma. And this is a crucial term which comes from the change of variables. If you look at this, the effective potential for this has a minimum. So in the large N expansion, after suitably rescaling the fields, it becomes quite clear that the large N is dominated by the saddle point, which is the minimum of this potential. So what is the minimum of the equation which determines the saddle point? That equation is this. This, of course, has two solutions, which has sigma equal to plus or minus. But in this case, it is quite clear what solution you have to take. The solution you have to take is, of course, the positive. This is a positive real quantity, and so the sigma naught is n upon 2k. This gives the correct ground state energy and is consistent also the equal point to equal time two-point function, because that is supposed to become this object. Because remember, sigma was xx. So if I evaluate xx at equal time, that correlation function should agree with what I get. And that, of course, is n upon 2k, as you can check. If you want to calculate the leading 1 upon n corrections, you got to expand around this saddle point. So I have done the expansion with suitable powers of n and k so that, you know, this is a valid expansion. And what you get is, of course, again, another quadratic action. You can't get anything other than a quadratic action because it started out with a quadratic action, which has, which is again a harmonic oscillator, but with the frequency which is twice the frequency of what you started out with. It has to have twice the frequency because it's like a pair of particles which are being created for the singlets. And this is a spectrum of that thing. This was just the quadratic part. However, so this just came from here, but however, the expansion was an expansion of sigma, which is downstairs. So expanding the Jacobian is going to give rise to an infinite set of interaction terms in the Hamiltonian. These interaction terms are important, and in fact, those interaction terms are the ones which are going to give you the higher point correlation functions of this harmonic oscillator. You could do all that. People have done that ad nauseum, and you know, of course, everything works the way it should. I'll also need to point out that for what we were going to do for SPN, it is necessary to know what are the singlet wave functions. For example, if you look at the ground state wave function of the n-dimensional harmonic oscillator, that of course is a standard Gaussian. So it's this thing which is linear in this collective field sigma. And once you expand that around the saddle point, it is linear in the fluctuation eta. On the other hand, you should reproduce this ground state wave function starting from that Hamiltonian for the sigma which I started out with, which became, remember, that was the Hamiltonian. And after the expansion, this was the 1 upon n correction. So that means the quadratic term. So the ground state wave function for this is a Gaussian in eta. So that's like this piece. But however, remember, in going from the x variables to the sigma variable, there was a Jacobian. So the true ground state wave function is this thing multiplied by a power of Jacobian. Once you expand this sigma around the saddle point, it will generate the whole series of terms which are higher and higher powers of eta. And since we have only looked at the quadratic part of the fluctuation Hamiltonian, it is only necessary to expand this to second order terms in eta. And when you do that, what you find is that as expected, you are going to get back what you knew to begin with. Of course, this is like doing a very easy problem in a very hard way, and it was not necessary to do it this way because this was, of course, after all, the harmonic oscillator. But this becomes very handy when you actually turn out to the field theory, which is a little more difficult to do. The technology for doing the quantum field theory is not very different at all from what I just described. So I'll not describe the details, but just give you the results. Once again, the analog of that radial variable is this bilocal field. You can write down what the Hamiltonian is. And what you find is the energy spectrum is again the sum of the energies of each of the particles which you started out with. That's what you would expect. And you can find what the Feynman correlator is in terms of in just expanding this Hamiltonian around the quadratic point. For the interacting O-N field theory, this propagator, of course, for the free theory is just a sum of harmonic oscillators. It's quite trivial. The interesting comes when you have the interacting theory. This propagator, together with the nonlinear terms in the fluctuations, now provide a set of Feynman rules to compute the correlators of singlet operators of the theory. And with the identification of the Poincaré coordinate Z, which I just mentioned in one of the earlier slides, what people have checked, that it gives rise to correlators which are exactly the ADS correlators. For example, if I look at what the action for the bulk scalar of the ADS dual theory is, it looks like that. There is a mass square, which is a negative mass square, which is minus 2, but that is what is required for the scalar field to be conformally coupled in an ADS spacetime. Okay. That's why it's an m square equal to 2. Of course, we did this long detour in the ON theory since we are going to follow exactly the same steps for the SP2N model and see where we end up. So what do we do for the SPN model? Once again, I've introduced these bilocal fields before. And it is important to note that while this is a Grassmann even object, this is not quite a bosonic field. This is not like psi dagger psi in an usual bosonization, because this is like more like psi psi. So n powers of these fields at the same point is going to vanish. Okay. To probe the singlet sector, we first examine again the SP2N oscillator. In this case, and all this, there is no x or y dependent, there is just a single mode. This can be considered to be a single mode of the field theory. And the SPN oscillator we already discussed, and you can immediately check that the endpoint correlation function of the rows is exactly the negative of the endpoint correlation functions of the sigma. This only happens because this is the minus 1 in the fermion loop, which comes in this the leading order in the large N calculation. There is a coordinate representation for this Grassmann object, where phi is represented as phi and p is represented as minus I dd phi. And you can use the standard technique to calculate what the Jacobian from the change of variables from the phis to the rows. And this is the Jacobian. And this leads to the collective Hamiltonian for the SP2N oscillator, which I've written like that. These expressions are, in fact, quite formal, again, because rho is not really a bosonic field. But the surprising thing is that this Hamiltonian is exactly the same as the Hamiltonian for the ON oscillator. There's nothing different about it if I replace rho by sigma. So where does the difference come from? As I said, even though this is not a bosonic field, we are going to treat this Hamiltonian in the spirit of a large N expansion. And in the large N expansion, this feature that some power of rho becomes actually identically vanish, which tells you that there is a maximum number in the oscillator that tells you there is an upper bound to the energy spectrum. In the field theory, this means there's a maximum number of two particle states in the theory, which is it's not uncommon in large N theories. Sometimes we call it a stringy exclusion principle, but it's sort of like that. But in the 1 upon N expansion, all that is invisible because in a 1 upon N expansion is expansion around N equal to infinity. We'll work from there and see what we get. Since we have the same Hamiltonian, we have the same saddle-point equation. So the saddle-point equation was exactly what it was before. But however, now we have a choice of sign for rho, because rho was not a real positive variable to begin with. So therefore, the saddle point value of rho can be positive or negative. In fact, what sign rho has to be is to be dictated by the fact that the saddle point value of rho should be exactly equal to the two-point function of the SPN fields. And what it turns out is that the correct saddle point is given by the negative solution to this equation. As a few checks that this is the correct saddle point, what you find is that you can calculate what the ground state energy is on this, which is just plugging in the saddle point in the Hamiltonian. You find exactly the negative ground state energy as is required for a fermionic oscillator. And it's sort of interesting that these two models, the ON and the SPN model, are in fact the two different solutions of the same collective Hamiltonian. You can follow the fluctuations exactly the same way as you did for the usual harmonic oscillator. And here you come to the second surprise, maybe not that surprising. You find that the quadratic Hamiltonian is negative definite. In fact, it looks, I mean, I shouldn't call it negative definite because these objects are not bosonic objects, but it is negative of what for a standard harmonic oscillator is. So what do you do with such a thing?
If
the Hamiltonian of the theory. Okay, I should tell you, this is all in the large N expansion, this one, right, I understand. So that's actually sort of reflected by the negative sign here. If you quantize the theory in the usual way, this Hamiltonian has an unbounded spectrum. I mean, this Hamiltonian, normally what you would quantize this theory, it's going to take a state which is annihilated not by A, but by A dagger because of the opposite commutation signs here. And then you act A to lower the states all the way to infinity. And that's the intuition here. But I'll tell you something a little bit different from what is to be done here. So it is exactly that thing that's giving rise to this. So as I said, under normal circumstances, given this Hamiltonian, this has an unbounded spectrum all the way down to minus infinity with an upper bound on the energy. But that's not what was the spectrum of the SP2N oscillator. The SP2N oscillator had a lower bound, you know, lower bound and an upper bound to the energy. You don't expect to see the upper bound to the energy because you're doing a large N expansion, but you want to see a spectrum which agrees with that spectrum by identifying one of these states, which what one would call the vacuum states of this. It's not really the vacuum. You want to identify one of those states of this bounded spectrum to be a state of this theory. The guide comes once again, because you know what the solution is, so you know what you should do. It turns out that, so as I said, this is exactly what I said, that this does not seem to be a thing. And the key to the point is that this object, once again, is not a true bosonic variable. And there are, in fact, other possibilities which, in fact, give rise to the correct solution. And this will turn out to be important. It turns out that this is one of the strange things about this model, is that the correct state, which has to be identified with the ground state of the SP2N oscillator, is a state which is annihilated by not by a dagger, but by a. And this, you would say, is madness, because if you work out what the wave function for such a state is, the wave function looks like that. This is an anti-Gaussian. And if this thing was a usual bosonic variable, then this would become, of course, inadmissible. However, we will now argue that this is, in fact, the right wave function. This is exactly what is required to obtain what I had shown earlier before. And the reason why this is admissible is because this is actually a product of two Grassmann objects. So when you normalize wave functions, you got to do a Grassmann integral. And doing that Grassmann integral, it's just, in your mind, you're approximating this thing by an integral over this object xi, but that's not really true. But when you do the Grassmann integral, that sign of this term doesn't really matter. Okay, that's a well-defined integral. So I'll now run a check of why this is the correct solution to take. And once again, the check comes from writing out what is the ground state wave function in terms of the original variables of the theory. So namely, this is the ground state, the claimed ground state wave function from the fluctuation part of the Hamiltonian multiplied by the suitable factor of the Jacobian. It should give rise to exactly whatever ground state you obtained in the first place without going through all this technology of the collective fields or not. And that turns out to be precisely correct. This sign here has to be precisely plus in order to reproduce what you already knew is the right answer. The order one corrections to the spectrum viewed in this way are positive, just as in the exact answer. However, unlike the exact answer, we cannot see the upper bound of the energy. I think that's because we are working around the limit n equal to infinity, where this upper bound is at infinity. And the two-point correlation function of the collective field is exactly the negative of the two-point correlation function of the ON theory, exactly as it is required. So this strange quantization of this effective theory is forced upon you by requiring that this is the correct effective theory, which reproduces whatever you started out with. So what is the consequence? One consequence of this fact is that not only the two-point function is the negative of the ON two-point function, but all n-point functions are negative of the ON theory. And the way it comes about is as follows. So as I said, when you take the collective Hamiltonian and you expand it around the saddle point, you generate all interaction vertices, three-point interaction vertices, 4 points and 5 points. And they come about because there is an expansion of 1 upon rho as 1 upon rho plus xi, and then you do a binomial expansion of that. Now, since the rho naught, what you started out with, is the negative of whatever you had for the ON theory, then you will see that these interaction vertices come with alternating signs, like any odd power, even powers of the fluctuations have a negative sign compared to the ON theory. Well, odd powers of the fluctuation have the same sign as the ON theory. Using this fact and the fact that you have proved that the two-point function is the negative of the two-point function, it's easy to show, I'll not give you the argument, it's easy to show that any n-point function is going to be the negative of the n-point function of the ON model. The collective theory of rho gives the right result in a perturbation expansion in 1 upon n, but at various stages, we have to remember about its Grassmannian origin. And this, I think, is a lesson for any proposed dual for this kind of theory of ghosts. The proposed dual would have a set of bosonic fields which are living in higher dimensions, but these bosonic fields are not really bosonic fields. And at various points, you have to do something quite unconventional to these bosonic fields in order to really reproduce the original field theory answer. The most important aspect of the Grassmannian origin is the finite number of states for a given oscillator, for a given mode. And this, of course, is not visible in the 1 upon n expansion. Whatever I said for the SPN oscillator, of course, generalizes to the SPN field theory. And I'll not go through the details by mode. Every mode of the field theory is like an oscillator. And you can establish, starting with this collective field theory, the general result, which is at the backbone of this proposal. Let me now come to the point, what has this got to do with De Sitter space? Why De Sitter space? It's a bit intriguing, because if you were to do this theory in Euclidean space, so treating the Hamiltonian as a log of the transfer matrix, the conformal symmetry of at the conformal points are the isometries of either Euclidean anti-De Sitter space or a regular De Sitter space. They have the same conformal symmetries. So from that point of view, it's hard to figure out which one is the right one. What I will now argue is that those negative signs which came propped up at various places is in fact the clue to what would be the right interpretation. So we saw that the kinetic terms which we came up was exactly the negative of what you would have got from the ON theory. So as a result, if you follow through that identification of the ADS from the ON, what you would get is an action, for example, for the scalar, which would exactly like the ON action, but an overall negative sign in front of it. This is, of course, a sickness of the theory, but the theory was sick in a conventional sense to begin with. So what are we going to do with this negative sign? The negative sign then, in fact, cries out for a double analytic continuation, where one of the coordinates z becomes some I times tau, and what was original time becomes some I times some w. So what it makes the original theory Euclidean, and it sort of invents a time out of nothing. In that case, if you work out what you get is an action which looks like an action in De Sitter space. This is the kinetic term. And quite significantly, the mass term, which here did not change sign. It had 4 powers of z in it. So I to the 4 is plus 1. And the mass square, in fact, does not change sign. It should not change sign, because the scalar curvature has changed sign in going from ADS to DS. So the conformally coupled scalar field in DS has mass square equal to plus 2 and not mass square equal to minus 2. Okay. So that you got it right. The holographic direction, we haven't invented time out of anything. It's just we got something, and we try to interpret what we got in a space-time fashion. And this is very reminiscent of the way we interpret coordinates on the wall sheet of a string in usual string theory. And then there is a well-known story there that if you deal with string theories in arbitrary dimensions of non-critical string theories, the Liouville mode behaves like an extra coordinate in the target space. Except this extra coordinate in target space has to be identified as a time-like coordinate for supercritical strings. It has again got to do with a negative sign in front of the kinetic term for the Liouville mode. So this is, in fact, very similar to that. And so I think the interpretation, again, in terms of the Liouville interpretation in terms of De Sitter space is also quite analogous. I should mention that this keeps happening for the quadratic term for every higher spin field. I should also mention that we started out with a model which contained ghosts. We lived with them for a while. I mean, in the Euclidean theory, it's not clear what theory of ghosts, what kind of pathologies it would really have. But the point is that I think one shouldn't really expect a theory in De Sitter space to be a conventionally well-defined theory. There's something pretty funny about the theory. We are trying to figure out what funniness of that theory is related to what funniness of some other field theory we started out with the hope that we understand a little bit better what's going on. And it has, I should also point out that it has been recently been realized in this very interesting paper that such non-normalizable wave functions of the type which we have encountered also appears when you do, just could be in fact essential for a DSCFT correspondence. I'll not go into the details of that. We have emphasized that the fact that the dimensionality of each momentum mode in the Hilbert space is finite is a reflection of the Grassmannian origin, and the expansion around n equal to infinity makes it quite invisible. And the lesson of this is that the duality of the SP2N theory, or for the any theory for that matter, to higher spin theory in De Sitter space has to be taken with this important grain of salt. And the higher spin description can at best be only a perturbative description in the Newton constant, which is RdS squared divided by N. The bilocal collective field, in fact, looks even worse. Because suppose there are, instead of a continuum, you have k points in space. So you have basically k independent momentum modes. So therefore, the theory is equivalent to k different oscillators, each of them n dimensional. Okay? Now, if there were just k fermionic operators, so there are k square collective oscillators because these are bilocal variables, and each oscillator can give rise to an infinite number of multiparticle states. On the other hand, the k fermionic operators can at most give rise to 2 to the power n k states because each oscillator has n components and there are k of them. Each of them can be either occupied or not occupied. So that's the maximum number of states which you can obtain. And all this thing is, of course, completely invisible in the formalism which I discussed, because that makes these things look like ordinary bosonic fields, which is just not quite true. I will now describe a kind of very briefly an algebraic statement, algebraic kind of formalism, which automatically incorporates the Grassmann origin. And I'll be a little fast in it because this is a bit technical. Okay. So what we do here is write this S in, these are the original oscillators of the SPN model. These are fermionic oscillators to begin with. And we organize the invariance in terms of three kinds of operators, which I call S, S dagger, and B. If you are familiar with Schwinger's oscillator representation of angular momentum, this is exactly a generalization of that. These form a closed algebra, and the closed algebra is in fact a kind of generalization of an infinite dimensional generalization of the SU2 algebra. If there was just, you know, one of them, this would be just Schwinger's construction, and in Schwinger's construction, you construct the angular momentum generators in this particular fashion. So if there are k points in space, that means k possible values of momentum, then each of these objects are k by k matrices. Okay? However, all these operators are not independent of each other because there is a Casimir invariant of the theory. The Casimir invariant is given by the left-hand side of this, or some combination thereof. And you can evaluate this Casimir invariant on that vacuum which I defined in that theory. So it gives a definite number for the Casimir invariant. So what this means is that this representation of whatever this generalization of the angular momentum algebra is a representation for one particular value of the angular momentum. So this condition, together with that algebra, defines a kind of a Kähler structure in that space. And there's a classic work of Berezin in which you just calculate the volume of the manifold and therefore the total number of states I'll not go through this calculation. It's a very interesting generalization of the standard calculation of the way you calculate the volume of SU2 as a volume of a sphere, for example. And the result is this. It's an exact result for any finite n and any finite k. Okay. This then is the total number of singlet states in the theory. The singlet states are, of course, created by all these operators S dagger. It turns out that you can solve the Casimir constraint in terms of a canonically conjugate pair, which I call psi and pi psi, in this following fashion. And then one of the generators, in fact, becomes this collective Hamiltonian, which I written down above. But let me not go into that. Now, the fact is that the small values of k, this dimensionality which I wrote down, in fact, goes like n upon k square. Okay. For example, if there were just 2 points in space, there would be, you know, like n to the 4, because you can just pair two of them in many different ways. However, if you look at that formula, for k to be much, much larger than n, so you're trying to get to the continuum limit, you find that the dimension becomes exponential of this 2 times k log 2. So it's 2 to the power 2 n k, the total number of states, and that's exactly the dimensionality without any singlet constraint. We don't completely understand this result, but what must be happening is that on the infinite dimensional plane, even though for a finite number of points, the number of singlet states are much smaller than the total number of states, but then the number of points have grown, you know, sufficiently fast so that, you know, once again in some limit, this result appears. Finally, I'll have just a few comments on a different way of viewing of why it should be a de Sitter space rather than an Euclidean anti-de Sitter space. So this is some work which I'm doing with my student Diptarka and with Gautam Mandal at Tata. And the question we posed is the following. So if we start with a Euclidean theory, a three-dimensional space, the symmetry group is SO4, 1, which is a symmetry group of either Euclidean AdS or DS. How do I decide between the two? The bulk of my talk was to show that if you make a construction directly from a specific theory, you are sort of forced into an interpretation like this. I'll now give a different perspective of the same result. The hint actually comes from studying holographic renormalization group. The holographic renormalization group are basically Hamilton-Jacobi equations of the bulk theory, which becomes interpreted as RG equations of the boundary theory. And of course, Hamilton-Jacobi equations, as it follows from the Schrodinger equation, depends on the signature. And in fact, I mean, Schrodinger equation in with a time has I del psi del t equal to h psi. In Euclidean space, it's a kind of a diffusion equation, del psi del t equal to h psi. If you trace it through, something very interesting happens. It turns out that these equations for DS point out to a very specific kind of non-unitary conformal field theories, which I'll just try to explain the basic idea. The idea is as follows. Suppose I start with a Euclidean large N conformal field theory with a conformal field theory which is perturbed by a trace square operator. You could also add in just a single trace operator to begin with. Then it is well known from the work of Witten and his generalization by Vecchi that the beta function for this coupling to large N has just 2 terms. The first term is just basically giving the reflects the conformal dimension of this operator, and the second term comes from the operator product expansion of O square going to O square, which involves the 2-point function of the operator itself and that coefficient center. This is a factor of gamma. Ratio of gammas, which I have omitted in here. The point is that in normal theories, normal unitary CFTs, this 2-point function is positive and this number is positive. Okay? And in fact, this agrees very nicely, this beta function comes out very nicely from holographic renormalization group in anti-De Sitter space. Okay, that's of course a very well-known story. If you look at the holographic RG equations in De Sitter space rather than in anti-De Sitter space, what you find is an equation which looks like this, except the sign of this term is negative, which points to a fact that whatever conformal field theory it comes out from has to have a negative two-point function in this following sense. But that's exactly what we had, and that exactly if you work out the beta function for an SPN model, that's exactly where this comes from, for example. It's, as I said, all endpoint functions are negative of the ON endpoint functions. It's a sign of, it's one of the consequences of non-unitarity of the theory. But we think that this thing is actually a lot more general than this particular instance of a claim of a DS-CFT correspondence. And the hope is that it's going to give a slightly different perspective into the kind of CFTs which could possibly be dual to quantum gravity in De Sitter space. So we are not finished with that yet, but we hope to get some insight. To finish, I would say that DS-CFT is very poorly understood. Our hope is that if we can establish a direct connection of the higher spin theory to the collective field or to the model which you just started out with, if there is a construction of the bulk from the boundary, that may be a good tool for addressing some of the deep questions in DS-CFT. And of course, one of the most tantalizing questions is the finite entropy of De Sitter space, about which I have nothing to say about. Thank you.
So, how does the finite entropy of the De Sitter space compare to the finite dimensionality of the Hilbert space?
Yeah, you know, the finite dimension is for one particular mode.
Otherwise, you have infinity.
Yeah, because there are infinite number of modes, you actually have infinity in what we got. Now, I'm not sure what it sort of goes halfway in the sense that you did get a finite in some place, but I don't think that's the answer. That was our motivation to do the latter part of the calculation, but he sort of quickly realized that it doesn't actually address that issue. I should also point out that the finite De Sitter entropy actually comes very naturally in the static patch. And if you look at the point on the boundary where the horizons of the static patch cross scribe plus and scribe, it's like a point. I don't know what the significance of that to this calculation, which is in the, what is this called, the inflationary patch of De Sitter space. I'm a bit unclear about that.
If you go back to the beta function, are you assuming something, or, well, you, this is just part of the story, but are you assuming something about delta or the coefficient of the other term? Like, are those real delta?
Yes. These are assumed to be actually real, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And this particular instance of the ADS-CFT, or for that matter, DS-CFT, the mass square is in the range where the deltas are always real. The importance of this thing, and we are not completely clear about the mechanism, is that this coefficient is somehow related to unitarity properties of the theory. And that's precisely the coefficient which turns to be the wrong sign in the De Sitter space. So that's the hint.
And so another, perhaps, well, if we go back, at some point we were doing double analytic continuation interpretation with the sitter. Can I do half of that and get Euclidean to sitter? And if so, what did I cover and what happened?
So the double analytic continuation came because I started with Lorentzian bounded.
Yeah. Oh.
If I started with Euclidean boundary, it would be just one analytic continuation.
Okay.
And that currently continuation was sort of natural because of this wrong sign in front of the action. Again, pretty much, it's like this 25 minus C in the Liouville theorem. Yeah. Pretty much like that. I don't know whether there's another interpretation, but this is certainly a...
Is there, well, just to speculate, is there room for
continuing
and getting the Euclidean? I don't know, just...
Yeah, I'm confused. Euclidean Disiter is just S4.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a boundary.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what to make of it. So, I mean, somehow Euclideanizing...
But a natural place to do that in your model. I don't know.
To make everything Euclidean?
Yeah.
I think then you'll be sort of stuck with the wrong sign in front of the action. So if you didn't do the analytic continuation of this new coordinate which came, it would be a Euclidean action with a negative sign. So you're stuck with that. So in a sense, a negative sign Euclidean ADS is sort of behaving like a disorder. As I said, I don't know what this means, but I think it's might provide us some hints about whatsoever.
Questions? Let's thank our speaker again.